The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 320, panel discussion, relationships and sexual addiction, Mormon style.
That means that I should say very good things about her, so she returns the favor. The topic of our workshop today is relationship and sexual addictions, Mormon style. Mary Beth Raines is a licensed clinical social worker and a marriage and family therapist in private practice here in Salt Lake City. She's also been a professor at the University of Utah and was co-editor of Peculiar People, Mormons and Same-Sex Attraction. What I really care about Mary Beth is she's a dedicated intellectual besides being a warm, caring therapist. I've heard her many times, and one thing that I really appreciate about Mary Beth is that she integrates a lot of well-thought-out theory with her work. I also enjoy having breakfast and lunch with her occasionally, but I feel bad. We really get into this giant discussion, and we both have to go back to work, and she's nice enough to say, we just get started. So I'm really very happy to do this panel with her today. Before she stands up, let me just tell you a little about what we're going to do. Mary Beth is going to discuss relationship addictions, and then I'm going to talk about sexual addictions. In so doing, I want to repeat that sexual and relationship addictions is hardly peculiar to Mormonism. That it exists across the board for everyone, or all cultures. We're going to talk about some of the particular unique messages that make a difference with Mormon clients. Mary Beth.
I'd like to start today with giving a context of what addictions are, given that concept and the whole process of theory and treatment is developed outside of a religious culture. I'd like to just briefly give some statements about that. In effect, all addictions are relationship addictions, whether we are addicted to a substance such as food, to a process such as sports or TV, or to another person, i.e. a love object. The addiction is the particular relationship between the person and the thing he or she cannot do without. Given this, there are some things that all addictions have in common, and these particular qualities I'll be talking about, even though there's a longer list, is integral to the other comments I'll make about how addiction occurs in relationships. First of all, an addiction is always formed around an underlying human need that is absolutely essential to the person's survival. That is emotional survival as well as physical survival sometimes. Secondly, the substance, process, or person who is feeling the need obsessively whatever a person is addicted to has an obsessive quality about it. A person will make many efforts to not be addicted, to not get over-involved, to not do too much, and despite those efforts, in fact, the behavior, such as a sexual addiction or food addiction, will continue despite risk, despite horrible consequences. It's a life out of control. And that starts to encroach upon the other areas of life. And that's the third situation, which is that other values and other relationships in life are often hampered, hindered, or shunted aside in favor of what a particular addiction is because, and this is my integral point that I'll bring up later, an addiction is formed oftentimes to fill the underlying need that cannot be filled. And so it is a compensatory device. It's a compensatory device, and it often is signaled when a person is stunted or kept at a certain developmental level and is not allowed to go on in the normal developmental map. So much of my theory in talking today is about essentially developmental psychology and how an addiction forms when our culture presses on us in a certain way and doesn't allow certain kinds of behavior or development of the self. It's true that every culture does that. Ours only creates our shoe for us in a particular way. I'm using the term relationship addiction today instead of the commonly held word codependence because I think codependence is a value-laden idea and has been more typically written in books aimed towards women, and I think it's a broader issue. But I do have a joke about codependence or relationship addiction that is classic, and that is a person is drowning and another person's life flashes before his or her eyes. The core need around which relationship addictions or codependence is formed is loving. Being loved and loving are core emotional and, I believe, spiritual needs in our lives. And when we are constricted or not allowed to or have too much trauma or have mistakes that can't be healed, then we oftentimes pick up one style or another, either over-connected or under-connected, as a way of coping with that rather than being able to continue in our normal developmental process. As most commonly defined, however, the relationship addict is dependent upon another for his or her source of orientation or for caretaking the other person's life, while the individuated person is the primary source of orientation for nurturing one's own self. So the codependent is oriented to other, the independent or healthy person in common literature is oriented to oneself. In my sense, this definition is incomplete, that relationships are far more complex and that a broadened definition is needed in order to make sense of the Mormon cultural world. Jean Baker Miller, in a piece called The Development of Women's Sense of Self, asserts that the mature person is more, not less, relationship-oriented as she or he works out more and more different and refined ways of being in relationship interactions. A person who refers to other, self, and the surrounding group while not losing sight of any of the three is far more mature than one who primarily focuses only on oneself or others being secondary. Kara Gilligan, in an author of A Different Voice, would agree, of course, in that she cites from her research finding that girls and women orient moral reasoning decisions around how to achieve satisfaction between two people in a relationship in a moral predicament, rather than orienting just to the principle of what is right and wrong. Using this definition, and I realize it's a fairly complex one, a relationship addiction would take many forms, and it, in this sense, becomes more than just a women's issue. A person could, in my definition, be primarily or only following another person's cues and behavior and be relationship addicted. Another person could be only following their own minds and hearts and be relationship addicted because he or she would be forcing those in relationship to him or her to orient back to him without being aware of all the support that is being given by the person who is in relationship with them. In other words, a person who is only oriented to self in a relationship is treating the other person as not a person, but as an object in which to transact life in a series of actions toward long-term goals, whether it's financial freedom or the celestial kingdom. Now, that object may be a mother object, a friend object, a lover object, a secretary object, but still in all, an object. And objects are easy to become addicted to use, to acquire, to discard, to fill oneself up with, or to leave behind. So coming around again to building my definition, a relationship addiction occurs when a person uses another as an object in any form of over-involvement or under-involvement. A person who is seemingly detached and independent from a relationship in a family, yet is in it for a period of time, is also addicted, although it's hard to see. Avoidance of something obsessively is as addicted as involvement with something obsessively. In food addictions, it's fairly easy to see that someone who is anorexic and is avoiding food to an obsessive amount is just addicted to someone who is a compulsive eater and can't do without eating or thinking about eating almost all of the day. So, for example, a person who is always at work, doesn't come home, yet expects another to provide support services is as a relationship addicted as a person who is codependent, who loves too much, who gives unrelentingly to the more classically independent person. So, the more complex and individually tailored relationship interaction skills we have, I realize that was a big mouthful, but in other words, the more skilled we are, I mean, it's applicable in other terms, whether you're playing tennis or, you know, doing a boat, the more skills you have, the more tools in your toolkit, the more skilled and mature you are, and that's also the case in relationships. And you are paradoxically more independent the more relationship skills you have. Because you have the accompanying refined judgment about which skill to employ when. When to enter, when to talk, when to take a turn, when not to take a turn. And people who pick up one style or another style simply don't have that kind of skill. In fact, those relationships judged to be the healthiest seem to have an equal balance of turn-taking, talking in silence, giving and receiving, and it occurs in a seemingly natural way. But actually, what happens is that both persons are attending to all factors. So you actually have four people in the relationship, one attending to oneself and simultaneously one attending to the other, and the other person is doing the same. So that it's not just any simple interaction between two people. People are both kind of rowing their boat in some kind of synchrony that allows self and other to flow freely between each other. In my definition, a relationship person who doesn't do that sifting back and forth, whether they only orient to the other or they only orient to themselves, will often not only use a person as an object, but within Mormon culture sometimes uses actions, righteous intent, as the thing that then creates one's life rather than connection to or awareness of another. Using my definition of addiction in relationship, doesn't that make all relationships addicted? Aren't we all, to some degree, that? Actually, yes. To a degree, none of us come from perfectly healthy families. We all have our style, so to speak. If you'll think for just a moment, and kind of look inside as I'm talking, you probably can identify fairly quickly whether you like more connection in long-term relationship, more everyday interaction, more intimacy, or whether you like more distance and whether you like to come close once in a while, but actually you like to have more autonomy. And most of us pick up one style or the other. Most of us are either the seeker or the sought in a relationship. We have a style that we get ingrained to, that we are taught in our family or that somehow fits our personality, and we maintain that through a lifetime. And that style always gets in our way. It's just like no runner is perfectly balanced legs. It's pronated one way or another. And so over time, we have to learn to continue to balance our style, even though we will never, in some sense, be perfect. And in fact, if you look at the paradigm I'm using, the goal isn't to become perfect. The goal is to become balanced, which it's a focus on fulfillment rather than on perfection. In other words, I'm going to turn the old adage from a very famous book 2 decades ago of I'm okay, you're okay, into you're not okay, I'm not okay, and that's okay. Because the essential message in coming out of or recovering from or growing out of a relationship addiction is learning that we are very human, we have as many faults as we have strengths, and that we are deserving of love in any circumstance regardless. Let me explain a little bit more how this happens, and I'll turn more to Mormon culture. Some of you remember from college probably your beginning psychology class, Abraham Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs in Human Development. And the first ones are survival and safety, but the third one is social needs. And there are a number of things someday I want to talk to God about, my list of unanswered questions, and this is one of them. And that is, at the third level, there are two social needs that are always there in every person, but they're conflicting with each other. That's what I need to talk to God about. One need is for autonomy, and the other is for connection. And what we often do in relationships is that one person will pick up one need and carry it for both people, and the other person will pick up the other need and carry it for both people, rather than each person picking up both needs and carrying it for themselves. And it's hard to do. It's not an easy thing. We'd have figured this out if it was an easy thing. We would have done it a long time ago. So what happens is that style of avoidance or autonomy or independence becomes part of a person's personality style. And in our culture, American culture generally, and even throughout the world to some extent, men are given the task of being autonomous, of being free, of developing individuated self. And women are given the task of being the connected, related self. And each then has a hard time picking up the other. And what happens, I think, in this perennial war between men and women is that each is projecting onto the other the unowned part of yourself and can always have issues and complaints. That isn't to say that men really aren't jerks at time and women really aren't also. That is to say that's true. Every projection sticks because something is true in it. But essentially, we develop that seesaw, and when we refuse to pick up balancing those two needs in ourselves, and we want someone else to do part of it, then we become relationship addicted, and the outcome is that we do not learn to love. We do not learn to love ourselves, and we do not learn to love other people. So to mature, so we learn how to balance these, we have to do, essentially go through a developmental ladder. And to me, this is inextricably tied to how Mormon culture addresses developmental growing up issues among its members. And that is, and I'm going to say this very quickly, even though there are many maps to this, if you want to look at Eric Erickson or for developmental stages, if you want to look at Lawrence Kohlberg for moral reasoning stages, or Carol Gilligan, or whether you want to look at Robert Fowler for stages of spiritual development, those are all ways of conceptualizing this quick map I'm giving, which is that we are born, or at our youngest stages, are in a symbiotic, overlapping, undifferentiated state. Through various cycles, we move to splitting off somewhat an awareness of having our own separate body or own separate self. At the third part of that is we come back and try to somehow find a balance, much as the two-year-old who is screaming no to his mom at the same time. I think we do that with God at times. We push away and cling on at the same time. And that is a very awkward way of trying to integrate. But as we continue, we go through the same thing. We go through these very rough and awkward styles of joining and separating and joining and separating, trying to integrate a place where we can have both, essentially. And the place where people sometimes run into the biggest trouble is when they reach the adolescent stages, when they're not just picking up small issues of, I want to leave my socks on the floor and I don't want to have to pick them up and no, I don't want to eat right now, but big issues of, I want to drink or sex seems kind of interesting, you know, the big things. And that's where differentiation or splitting off or wanting to explore oneself comes sometimes straight into conflict with a larger culture or with one's parents who are interpreting the cultural and the religious life or religious rules. So many times that integration or balancing act or the need to do that stops, and a person will split into one side or the other, become primarily compliance or connected oriented or individuated or rebellion oriented, and have a hard time from there on out sometimes to pull back into balance the other side of it. One of the ways of doing this, let me just suggest a short little exercise with somebody you really care about, and yet you're in a fight about something and you haven't been able to solve it for a long period of time. The next time you meet this person, I'd like you to suggest something, particularly if it's around, say, a religious topic you're really hot about. And that is, you suggest that you change roles. That one pick up the other one's characteristic way of stating things, and that you pick up their characteristic way of stating things. And sometimes it even helps if you sit in opposite places or trade shirts or do something so that, you know, you have the other person's view on yourself, and that you then pick up that point of view and argue it or be in it as much as possible. It's very confusing and disorienting, and you'll see in a heartbeat why you don't want to pick up that role. Somehow there's some part of your own self that can't digest that piece or point of view. But in fact, that's exactly what one needs to do to become more balanced, to become more independent, more autonomous, and connected at the same time. So play with it. Some people can do it and not do it, but I think it's a good exercise to becoming more fluid within relationships and with even in spiritual matters, I think. The only way to learn this balancing act, unfortunately, to learn these intricate and freedom-giving skills in relationships, is allowing things to happen or being aware that things are happening in our life that are totally unacceptable. That we may have long periods of confusion, periods of guilt, and periods of paradox. And paradox is an absolutely important developmental stage to go through, understanding what it is, understanding that in many cases it can't be solved in the context we live in, understanding that we are absolutely at odds, and I'm going to put this back in a relationship context instead of the church, we're absolutely at odds with the person that we love. And I've worked with many couples in therapy where one person had a particular form of faith and living church and gospel principles, and another person had another form of faith. And the seesaw is often trying to convince the other, if you'll only see it my way, this problem could be solved. And a solution, sometimes, if people are quite flexible, merges into somehow a synthesis of the two. But I think it is as honorable and it is as compassion-giving that if they never solve the problem, but they continue to love each other. That it's unrealistic to think that you are going to solve some differences. That it's far more compassionate to eventually adopt a point of view that I'm working on balancing these issues in myself, even though I may never solve them. And I'm working on learning to live and love the people around me, even though they never change. And so that, over time, is a way that you can move developmentally forward, is that regardless what you feel, think, or do, you're not thrown out, or you're not pulled in and engulfed or smothered too much. You're allowed some flexibility and variability back and forth. And place where that sometimes runs into trouble, I think, in church culture is that some actions, as you well know, you're going to get thrown out for, or they're going to be a danger of it, or you will be thrown out in degrees, whether you then don't take the sacrament, that becomes then a public fact, which is, by the way, a relationship issue, your relationship to the whole community or congregation in which you're sitting or interacting with or your neighborhood, or whether it's within yourself that you throw parts of yourself out and say, you know, that's the, who is it, the Dr. Jekyll part of me, you know, or that's the devil on my shoulder, so we throw parts of our own soul out, or whether we literally excommunicate people and say, you are not deserving to be in our congregation. What that does is the very threat of it stops the developmental process for many people, and they would say, I'd rather be safe than sorry. And I think to develop into a mature person, we need to be safe and sorry, not one or the other. Or to say it another way, I have never met a wise person who was innocent. And that we learn as much from our mistakes as from our compliance, and we learn as much from our compliance as our mistakes. So you can see my thread to this point is weaving carefully that one can't be chosen over the other. We can't value thinking over feeling or feeling over thinking. Both are integral to our lives. And as I learned from Chauncey Riddle at BYU many years ago, surprised me today even this concept, is that when two qualities or two people or two roles are absolutely more important in a system or in a person, you cannot decide which one is most important. So that we are always in the horns of a dilemma, and that growing with wisdom over time means somehow riding those horns more and more comfortably, so we're riding in the middle on top of the head rather than out on the ends feeling pricked all of the time, as far as I can see. Let me just briefly summarize three things that I think are in Mormon culture that I think keep us from going through these developmental stages and develop the deepest levels of spiritual maturity, that is, the ability to love and the ability to know. The first is, well, I've already alluded to and talked about, in that Mormon culture values justice over mercy. We value compliance over loving. And that people who are in danger or have felt excommunicated in their own soul or pushed out. I had a client one time who I think I've already gotten some permission to say this. You wouldn't know who the person is anyway. We were doing a guided visualization, and this person came to a door, and it was the door to his soul and what his deepest knowing was and his deepest loving was, and he knew that. And I said, well, open the door and go in if you can. And he said, I can't. I don't have a temple recommend. And I said, do you need a temple recommend to the inside of your own soul? And there he decided, no, I guess I don't. I'm always allowed inside my own soul, regardless of what my outer life looks like. And so that sense of being allowed into your own soul, regardless of what's going on in your outer life, is an absolutely important part of becoming more and more healthy over time. Because compliance or justice is valued over mercy, and I don't think, by the way, that that's the church's intent. I don't mean to say that at all. I think that's the result over time. I don't think that's the intent. That means that somehow the paradox of justice and mercy can't be solved and hasn't been solved in an institutional context. And the institution itself has been stopped at a certain developmental stage so that people are then choosing one over the other. They're always a Mary or a Martha rather than having some connection between the two sides of the self. This provides people with only limited types of relationships that they can be in, unfortunately, and creates a more highly idealized stereotype view. Many women in the last few years have talked and written about being seen as a role and not a person. In fact, another therapist, Mormon therapist, and I have discussed how many Mormon women we have seen who have had affairs and experienced little regret. They feel badly that they hurt the people around them, but they feel little regret despite church consequences and sometimes family consequences, because it was the first time in their lives that they were treated like a real person and not a role. Now, whether they were or not is another issue. Their feeling was that they were treated like a real person and not a role. So we foster relationship addiction in that after a certain stage of psychological development, we prohibit or discourage increased and different ways of relating to each other, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the author of two books, one on flow, the psychology of optimal experience, and the other, the evolving self, asserts that stimulating more complexity into our lives increases happiness and a sense of meaning as we grow older. This complexity should have both differentiation and integration. He's saying the same thing, only in a different way. And that we need many activities that are worth doing for their own sense that emerge out of the person's own self. So that over time we form an interactive tapestry with someone or with all of the people in our lives rather than something that's fitting a certain pattern that is only fairly simplistic and repeated again and again in a certain way. The second thing that I think creates relationship addiction, let's see if I can find my, here it is that Mormon culture codes gender roles. Men are to be a certain way and women are to be another way. And because there is difficulty, either embarrassment or shame, or criticism, if you pick up the other role, or if you make a comment about that, or even a comment about role structure. I remember one time I was in the temple when my sister was being married, and my brother and my cousin were sitting on both sides of me in the room, and the person who was officiating said, we need two witnesses. And I raised my hand. I knew that this wasn't possible, but I raised my hand. And both my brother and my cousin quickly took my hand and put it down and said, down, Mary Beth. I love them both dearly, actually. We've had many discussions about these types of things, so it's not against them. I'm just showing you how that's a quick reactive, and there's a strong cultural map. The last thing is secrets. That what is right is so right, and what is wrong is so wrong, that what is wrong must be kept as a secret or only shared under very guarded conditions. And the process of keeping a secret has two or three consequences that we have to work through, and everyone does, by the way. Again, Mormons are not the only ones who have this. Every culture imprints this on people. It's just our particular style. The more secrets one has to keep, the more fundamental shame, that is a general sense of being bad or not okay, and the more guilt, which is the remorse and anger we feel about doing wrong, one feels. There is this fundamental shame that just keeps going through our lives, and that's the result of keeping secrets. The second result is the inability to build a hierarchy of values in our life. For some reason, for some people, feel French kissing is the same as sexual intercourse, or that lying for the Lord is okay. Because development has stopped, there is no way to discriminate wisely. There is no way to learn unless you go against or come outside the system. And I'd like to say that that occurs for us sitting in this room. I'm assuming since you're here in the room that you're somewhat differentiated or have some disagreement or have some independent opinion about church values, culture, the gospel, and so on. One place where we can get stuck is staying in the differentiated, individuated, being against, criticizing stage, and I realize my talk has a little bit of that quality in it today. I'm talking more about the negative things and the positive things. So I'm kind of coming from that second or that more individuated stage as my talk. What I have not included as much and should be included, but I ran out of time to do it, is how to integrate it so that actually I can flow back and forth. I can go to church if I want to go to church. I can go if I'm talking about me personally at the moment. I'm not talking about all of you. I can go. You have to be careful when you preach, you know, that I can go and not go. And it is depending upon what's most valuable to me at the moment, that I can align with or I can be against something, that I can pick up a compassionate attitude towards somebody that I was was very angry with yesterday, that I can do that back and forth in a way where I don't have compartments in my soul that are boarded and locked up. And because we have trouble with that integration stage, and because we haven't or we don't know a way to deal with mistakes and sin and the guilt and the shame and the secrets, we don't do the proper grieving, mourning, talking to others, doing the very things that become public and allow other people to show compassion for us and us to show compassion for ourselves to heal. And that healing then takes us to the next stage of integration. The last thing I think is a result of the secrets is fear. Fear of reprisal, fear of judgment, fear of what can happen and does happen. And on this one, I'll be real pointed, which is that I think the way that confidentiality is dealt with in bishops' interviews and in disciplinary actions creates a fear where actually something can be treated in a way that is out of your control and you aren't guaranteed compassion. That isn't to say there aren't a lot of incidents in which bishops and stake presidents and so on are very compassionate and understanding, trying to balance justice and mercy, but the experience of so many is different, and the fear is there still in all. And in fact, there is a double bind that a bishop is put into in a bishop's handbook in this regard, and that is, under some circumstances, a bishop is required to tell his stake president about a member's sin. And for the most part, they're sexual sins, but they're also apostasy sins. It doesn't matter what the member says. They're required to tell their line leader. Also, in the same handbook, the bishop is required to give the person in his ward confidentiality if that person invokes it. That bishop is required to not tell. So in the same handbook, the bishop is required to tell and not tell on conceivably the same circumstance. So in that sense, we are in a struggle, and we're not in a safe place about confidentiality, in a place where we can heal from our secrets and receive love at the same time. So let me finish just briefly, because I realize I'm taking all the time here, I'll summarize where we get stuck by reading 1 Corinthians 13:2. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could move mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. Thank you. I will introduce Glenn, who obviously has introduced himself just in his style of introducing me, but I will still say he is a licensed clinical social worker. He is an executive director of Odyssey House. He is assistant clinical professor at the Graduate School of Social Work, and he is the only one that I know who is an assistant professor who teaches in various specialty areas, not just in one specialty area. He's in private practice in Salt Lake City and lectures nationally and internationally on, again, a variety of topics. And I count Glenn as one of my best lunch friends. By that I mean we have developed over the years a relationship of talking, not just about ideas that are coming into our minds and what we're currently spinning on about, but I feel like when we meet, we really talk from our hearts, what really happens in our lives. And even though we only meet for lunch, it's one of my very best ways of experiencing him, and I think him me, and I thank him for that. Glenn?
Actually, I thank Mary Beth for that, but I really want to thank her for the revelation when she said some people can't distinguish between French kissing and intercourse. I thought, gee, I wasted a lot of time in college. Mary Beth. Mary Beth also wanted me to remind you that I actually outlined my speech in testimony meeting, and it is about sexual addiction. Now, if you think it's strange that during testimony meeting or speeches to think erotic thoughts, you're probably wrong. They actually did some research on what people do with speeches that are very discouraging to people like myself who speak. And that about 30 minutes after a speech, 80% of the audience don't remember what you talked about. And added to that, that any 50% of the time, people aren't paying attention. And they were very concerned about that result, so they studied it and discovered that in an audience, 50% of the audience are having erotic thoughts. And so... So I would just say, women are capable of erotic thoughts. But I would just say that if I do look over the audience today and you're drifting off and you're glazing over, you're leaving, not paying attention, at least I know you're having a good time. So... There are many sexual addicts and different types of sexual addictions. They exist in all cultures. The purpose of this presentation, however, is to explore some of the features and messages of Mormon culture, our cultural and psychological characteristics that I find very commonly amongst Mormon sex addicts. Some people would find the word Mormon sex addict an oxymoron, but they do indeed exist. Mormons, like all humans, are attracted to sex, think about sex, have sex, and can distort sex. But first of all, I'd like to review again what is addiction. I define addiction as a pathological relationship with a mood-altering chemical, relationship, activity, thing, or event that can become more important than family, friends, value system, or employment. It has a compulsive-driven quality to it and involves denial, delusion, distortion, dishonesty, and eventually despair. It brings about relief or euphoria and has tolerance changes. In other words, we need more of it to get the same effect. You can be addicted to substance, food, sex, relationships, work, shopping, exercise, video games, gambling, and even religion. Indeed, if you look at brain chemistry, man is inherently an addictive species. The brain releases mood-altering chemicals which create natural highs and lows. Dr. Robert Heath of Tulane University studied this and found that in a depressed person, the number of impulses to the pleasure regions of the brain is fewer than 20 per second. The normal range is 20 to 30, or in the high range up to 40. Now, in a normal orgasm, now don't ask me how they studied this, it's about 60. I don't know what a super orgasm encompasses. In very strong, powerful crack cocaine, it can be up to 200. That's why rats will seek in experiments, they will seek the stimulation rather than the food and starve to death. However, in addiction, we eventually deplete the natural mood chemicals, which means the lows are lower, and we require more highs. It is a prescription for addiction. This occurs in sexual addiction, and the resulting sexual behavior goes beyond the person's control, despite what could be severe consequences. Mood changes can become intense around the sexual activity, and people often push the limit, often in high-risk situations. Important questions to ask oneself if you're worried about sexual compulsivity are, is it secret? Is it abusive, exploitive, and degrading? Is it empty of a committed relationship? And is it used to avoid painful feelings and to alter moods? Now, I should say in sexual addiction, I am not talking about people that do things outside of church standards. I'm talking about people that do sexual activities that tend to get out of control more frequently despite the sacrifice that things are important to them. Most commonly, a sex addict begins with a person with very low self-esteem. There is usually underlying sense of shame and assumption that somehow that at one's core, one is basically a bad, unworthy person that feels that no one can love them as they are. These people easily feel bad about themselves and have self-esteem crises where they regress emotionally. In other words, that facade of feeling good about oneself is pricked, and you regress to a time when you felt bad about yourself. Since these people do not understand their feelings and needs, accept them, or know how to communicate about them, they externalize their need for relief. Something outside of them needs to take away the pain. In sexual addiction, it is sex, and the addict preoccupies on it and fixes on it to bring them pleasure. Their thinking becomes impaired. Emotional needs are all dumped into sex, and the rituals and sex bring relief. The behavior increases, which leads again to self-doubt and unmanageability, and fuels the inner emotional doubts that start the cycle all over again. Let's turn to Mormon dynamics. The first feature that I would like to spend time on are interjects, or what I like to refer to as parental tapes. These are things that we learned about ourselves from our culture, our parents, our religion, or whatever, while we were growing up. They help define who we are. Shame and fear are very important. Indeed, key to most sexual addicts, again, is a fundamental sense that one is inherently flawed, wrong, or sinful. I refer to this as shame, which is not just appropriate guilt for behavior, but a sense that one is flawed and unlovable. Lasting shame leads to numerous problems with self-esteem, depression, and addiction. And rarely have I seen patients with greater senses of shame and self-hatred than many Mormons I have seen. Mormon theology seems to support a loving God, but culturally we often see a judgmental and vengeful God, the one that sits up there and counts our sins. I remember when I was a kid, I was taught that there was this big movie that you got to see with your mother and father and all your relatives about your life. And therefore, I was very embarrassed every time I went to the bathroom. But since I found out how ridiculous that would be, unless, of course, we could sit there with a fast forward. Scott Peck, in A Road Less Traveled, talks about many people who grow up in many areas of their lives but retain their 8 to 10-year-old image of God. Many Mormons are raised in fear. Fear of not keeping a perceived vast variety of commandments and the dreadful and damning consequences of not living them. Not only will they be punished, but they will be separated from God and family. God and family will disapprove. God, therefore, becomes a projection of an exacting culture and parents who themselves live in fear and shame. As Mormons, we play lip service to Christ's great love, but we stress works, not grace. As a culture, we earn and work. We equate our worth with performance and living by a tick list of shoulds. We have a tough time being rather than doing. We externalize and measure ourselves and have the classic bind to be perfect, which inevitably leads to a sense of failure since we cannot be perfect. We forget that the great commandment is to love thy neighbor as thyself, not more than thyself. So many see a judgmental and rigid universe and measure themselves by standards that they are not able to reach. The result is a sense of shame in many, a sense of inherent unworthiness, and a sense of fear of lasting rejection. It is these very feelings that the addict tries to block out. I've seen this in many of my patients. An example I used was a man that went to church regularly, held a job, but that was addicted to going to prostitutes. He was sexually abused as a child, about 5 or 6, by a stranger. And when he informed his rigid stake president father, his father punished him rather severely, saying that he would not have been abused if he were not sinful. Therefore, he had fixated upon himself that he was sinful and unworthy. Then, as he became an adolescent and became more sexually inquisitive and active, that sense of shame became more intense. Likewise, he fixated on it because it was the only relief. The other thing was the dual. Keep this one secret separated from the rest of your life and look good to the rest of the world. Thus, look good, then run off because you can't eventually look that good and commit your secret addiction. This brings up the second feature I would like to talk about, and that is how we approach sexuality. I doubt that we as a culture will ever be accused of too much openness about sex. On the other hand, our prescriptions against it are ominous, even for behaviors that many would perceive as normal. Our socialization process about sex is often layered with judgments about it, teachings of damnation, and with a sense that any slight violation will bring dire consequences, damnation, and a sense that you are somewhat less of a person. Healthy sexuality is not taught. Teachings can include such things as pulling petals off flowers for young women, therefore conveying to them that they are damaged goods. Particularly, this is painful to sexual incest victims. thinking hymns to control erotic thoughts. I assume that's why Mormons are such excellent musicians. And even prescribing marital sexual behavior. I will never forget being asked in an interview by my bishop if I was immoral with my wife. I said I didn't know you could be immoral with your wife. And he listed a whole list of common sexual behaviors that were indeed immoral. I kept my mouth shut. The sin of sex is difficult to reconcile. Repentance or change is prescribed and often brings real risk, such as excommunication or loss of status. Therefore, the addict often remains stuck, wanting to change, but fearful of the consequences of confession. This socialization process has occurred in many of my patients. I'll use a female. She was raised in a prominent LDS family and was an incest victim, which has been true of all the Mormon women sexual addicts that I've seen. So she learned two horrible things, that one, that love is equated with sex, and secondly, she felt horrible about herself, but the only thing she had to give was sex. She also learned that she could not. It's interesting that her father, who was high status, hated her being a waitress when she was in her late teens and said, you know, a woman could earn more on her back than she can waitressing. She then began 3-year stint of prostitution. When she got married to a prominent person in the community, she started having sexual affairs with numerous men that were usually high-ranking businessmen, many of who held high rank in the church. Then she was introduced to the whole double standard and a couple of factors about how we learn about sex. One is that we can't communicate sex. And many of these men at least use this, saying that they could not communicate about sex with their wives. In fact, there seems to be a dual standard of love and honor versus desire. You cannot love and honor the person that you sexually desire. There is love and there is lust. She also reported to me that many of these men insisted on oral sex because oral sex was not adultery, whereas intercourse was. Now, in more troubling behavior, I have heard that excuse where a man who had molested most of his children and most of his grandchildren said, I had a choice between adultery and the lesser of sins. On males, I should state that many of them are also incest victims, but not all of them. But in most of them, their first sexual experience was layered with tremendous guilt and shame that tended to fixate on them being a terrible person. Of course, that brings up the need for relief, and they move back to the sexuality. Paradoxically, the very self-loathing about sex often leads to the very sexual behavior that is denied and the addiction that is so hated. One leads to shame and feelings of hopelessness, which leads to a need to silence the pain. One becomes fixated on the very act that brought them this in the first place, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There is pain, a need to cover it up, the sexual addiction to relieve it and bring pleasure, and then the recreating cycle. This brings up a third area of problems, and that is extremism. In our culture, there is a powerful socialization, hierarchy, and social control. This works well for some, but for many who feel that they don't measure up to what they feel are harsh judgments and demands, it is problematic. We are not a gray culture. We often think in extremes and black and whites. It is either all true or not. We are either perfect or hopeless. I see this repeatedly in Mormon clients. They try very hard but finally feel like failures because they can't meet their own harsh and overly high expectation. They despair or get angry and rebel. They go to great extremes to rebel and break away. If they can't be perfect and fit in, they are damned, so they might as well act the role. Example is alcoholism. Mormons drink at a lower rate than other cultures, but those that drink have extremely high rates of alcoholism. The same apparently goes for sexual addiction. We have not taught moderation. Indeed, Samuel and Cynthia Janus, in a recent survey of American sexual behaviors, found that members of conservative religions where sexual prohibitions were stronger actually began sexual activity earlier in life on the average. And while fewer members had sexual relationships outside of marriage, the ones that did had them much, much more frequently. Mormonism is hardly the only culture with these problems. They exist elsewhere. Besides, finally, the addict must accept responsibility for him or herself, acknowledge the problem, and overcome it. It is their problem. Most addicts desperately want to on some levels, and for all, it takes pain and courage to begin their healing. But then comes the question, does our culture support their healing or create some barriers? As a community, we have much richness and support. Our organizational abilities are laudable, but for those that stand aside because of pain, problems, doubts, or differences, the conflicts can be overwhelming. The first hurdle is secrecy. It has been said that we are only as sick as our secrets. Indeed, it is difficult to maintain an addiction without secrecy. Who is a sex addict to tell? When was the last time you went to Fast and Testimony meeting and had someone stand up and says, "Hi, I'm Brother Jones and I'm a sex addict"? The need to look good and the unspoken rules of what can and cannot be shared are too ingrained. Therefore, the addict often feels isolated with his or her dirty secret. We are not an open culture. The community is perceived as being right, and since people share only about their good side, your differences are about you being wrong. Who do you talk to when you feel alienated and sinful and you fear that anyone would reject you? How often do we talk about sex anyway, other than it being bad? As a culture, we have built a patriarchal hierarchy with truths, shoulds, and judgments very defined. Theologically, we believe in free agency, individual revelation, and responsibility to find truth. Culturally, however, we sometimes create a permanent parent-child relationship where individuation is difficult and emotional and moral development can become arrested. We remain in fear and shame. Unfortunately, our addictions can be used to silence the cries of our feelings and unfulfilled needs. Ironically, the very act of avoiding our negative emotions give them power to control our lives. Indeed, we are out of touch with the emotional needs and feelings because they don't look good and don't fit the prescribed feelings and needs one are supposed to have. The great rules of the dysfunctional family, don't talk, don't trust, don't feel, and I should add, look good all the time, are often practiced by us. Some of the greatest barriers to change or growth are perfectionism, fear, a lack of knowledge of one's emotional lives, a lack of ability to look at alternatives, and a feeling that deep down inside you don't deserve better. These barriers are all alive and well within our culture. It complicates the journeys back. Sometimes the addiction seems easier and certainly is quicker, but then life was never meant to be easy, and all of us must confront our own ghosts if we are to grow. As Mormons, we have learned that ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Indeed, the goal of mental health is reality. This is often difficult. As Lily Tomlin said, I can take reality in small doses, but as a lifestyle, it sucks. For the sexual addict to begin to heal themselves, they must first acknowledge the truth about themselves and begin to heal their negative feelings by learning to understand them in a respectful and caring way. Finally, they are not really different than the rest of us. We all need, we all hurt, and we all need to embark on our own journeys of growth, change, and love. Indeed, one of the most appealing parts of Mormon theology to me is the concept of an eternal journey. As Socrates said, "May the outward and inward man be one." I believe that in order to grow and that to learn to love, one must indeed spiritually and emotionally mature, or in my words, journey. Our culture has many good things and brings peace to many. But we are also human. We, like all others, make mistakes. I believe that it behooves all of us to create a more open and caring culture that finally supports and aids in bringing about our faith's power for personal transformation. As I change and become more open, so may my culture. Anne Morrell Lindbergh said that when one is a stranger to oneself, then one is estranged from others. Only when one is connected to one's love is one connected to others. All people in need are, metaphorically in a real sense, Jesus in disguise. And that person who may need that help tomorrow may indeed be ourselves. Thank you. We have about 3 to 4 minutes for questions, and Mary Beth and I will take them. Yes, Marty. Well, we'll both, I guess, try to answer this. The question, because I need to summarize it for the tape, is, first of all, it was a question that referred to homosexuality and reparative therapy that calls anything outside of abstinence sexual addiction. And the second part of the question, the need hierarchy, is sex. I'm really paraphrasing this. Is it a need, or is it like food and other things? And so, therefore, anything outside the marital procreation, I suppose, is an addiction. My brief response to that, in the first part, and I might get myself in, well, it's okay. I do think, on the homosexual issue, I do not believe that homosexual behavior or heterosexual behavior is addicted unless it becomes problematic and continual, and therefore, and people's lives, they can't sacrifice more important things for their sexual addiction. Indeed, I chose not to talk about homosexuality because I think that is not only a Mormon problem but a cultural problem. I think culture, American culture, Mormon culture, much of the world's culture really forces gays in many ways towards sexual addiction because they allow no role modeling that are public in order to look at intimate relationships. But secondly, they grow up with a fundamental sense of shame. If who you are is fundamentally wrong, evil, and flawed, how else do you get a relief? And then we don't want to make it public. I mean, the church would rather make it totally secret, excommunicating, etc. So where are gay people supposed to meet except in a sexual way? There's also, in terms of at least male homosexuality, lots of issues that have to deal with male socialization patterns, lack of intimacy, and that sort of thing. On the second part of that, I've wondered, where did religion, because historically and anciently, I don't think religion was always such a horrible sin, or it wasn't divided so much from spirituality. Indeed, I think in some religions today, there certainly is a better integration of sexuality and spirituality. You can throw darts, but I do not perceive spirituality and sexuality as mutually exclusive. And how we integrate that. So therefore, I do think sexuality is a need. It is an important human need. And the reality of it is there are very few people in the world that haven't participated in some form of sexuality. I actually think that sometimes we make a sexual addiction worse because we fixated on. One example of this is male Mormon interviews about masturbation. Of course, we know very few Mormon males masturbate. And I hate to, I should take off my glasses so I won't be accused of what I was told would happen to me when I grew up. But that obsession when you're very young and, for example, asked about masturbation, and of course the great secret of that is there are a lot of men that actually have masturbated as adolescents, females too. And you put so much stress on that. I know what my bishop would bring me in and said, Glenn, I'm so glad I don't have to talk to you about this because you're so righteous and you're so good and you're not like the other boys in this ward. Boy, did I feel terrible. But at least he didn't ask me. Do you want to respond to that question?
I would say essentially the same thing as Glenn, and since we're out of time, I will add only one thing, and that is, I think it is also a need, but it varies how needful it is. What we can't do out without is love, and that sex is one of the more potent ways. Probably, how many? 60 was it on a normal orgasm? Maybe 90 on a good one? No. That for some people, sexual interest, I mean, for everyone, sexual interest is on a continuum. For some people, it naturally occurs at a very low level, and for other people, it is very high all the time. And how does one who has a very high natural interest in sexual things and feelings, and yet is, how do you discriminate between that and addiction? And I don't think we've developed that idea or concept very well at all. But I think it's problematic for Mormons, heterosexual or homosexual, who are very, very, very interested in sex and think about it a lot and enjoy it a lot. And that sometimes is the real big secret.
Let me...